Hello and welcome to the Roy Harper podcast. This is episode number 26 for September 2009. In this show, we'll have an archive interview with Roy Harper. It was conducted by Dave Burnham in 1994 after a show at the Half Moon Putney, and I thought it might be quite fun to run an archive interview this time around. The A to Z of Harper, this time it's the letter Y, listener feedback, and of course, a selection of music. Playing in the background is Blue Stars by Matt Churchill, and long-time listeners to the podcast will remember that I interviewed Matt last year when I was over in Ireland. I'll put some links to Matt Churchill's MySpace page and other info on the show notes for those of you that haven't heard him yet and are interested in finding out more about what he's up to. Once that track's finished, I think we'll kick off the music with Elizabeth from Whatever Happened to Jugular.
Street in the face of a holocaust, with thunder in your voice, as in the grace of great numbers a world is made to feel your choice. And I love you for choosing to live with us and making some noise. It's time that we join our hands across our world. It's time that we join our hands to save our world. whatever persuasion you are, you must open your door if you mean to me. Come and be counted in whispers of multitudes, and come on your own feet. I'd love to be able to say my old grandmother marched to people the street. It's time that we join our hands across our world. It's time that we join our hands to save our world. It's time.
Thank you.
Now it's time for the interview. Now, Dave Burnham gave me the master tape of this interview last year when he came and did a podcast interview with me, and I've been kind of looking for an excuse to run it. And I think now is the time. And Dave has given me some background information, which I'll read out for you. If I remember rightly, I had come across a copy of the Ptolemaic Telescope around 1992 to 93 via my old friend Simon Williams, who was in a great psychedelic rock group called Mandragora, who have recently reformed. And there was a small piece featuring his band in it. I was impressed by the breadth of interviews and coverage in this magazine, so I approached the editor, Phil McMullen, to see if he'd be interested in running a piece on Roy. He basically suggested that I actually did the interview myself and then get back to him with the results. Further on, he says, I contacted Darren Crisp and asked him what he thought, and in due course he got back to me, saying Roy was up for it. In those days, Sue and I would regularly travel up to the Half Moon in Putney to see Roy, and it seemed logical to tie an interview in to a time when we'd all be in the same place, rather than do it over the phone or whatever. I think Roy was doing a two-nighter at the Half Moon, so the idea was to do the interview in the afternoon before the second gig. John and Jan Dixon very kindly put us up at their gaff as they lived in Putney at the time, so it was perfect. Plus the fact that John works for the BBC and had some great recording kit, so we could record the interview and transcribe it later on. I remember hanging out at John and Jan's place, watching the cricket, the sound turned down, and the Grateful Dead playing while we waited for the call from Darren or Roy. Come late afternoon, we got a call to say there'd been a change of plan and that we could do the interview after the gig, but if we wanted to pop along during the sound check, we could take some photos, etc. So that was how Sue, John and I came to be upstairs at the Half Moon in Putney, interviewing Roy, and the tape was primarily intended for the interview transcript, which Phil later ran in issue 18 of the Ptolemaic Telescope. Having rediscovered it in an archive box, it was fun to listen back to. I'm going to put a link to the final article in the show notes, by the way. It's still online, although one or two of the image links seem to be broken at the moment. Finally, Dave said, I wrote an introduction to the piece, which might be a nice way to introduce the recording. Roy Harper is a four-dimensional, artistic craftsman, foremost a poet inspired by the likes of Percy Shelley. Harper's lyrics are the core of his work. His guitar style is unique, powerful and captivating, from sitar-like caresses to a sonic storm whirlwind that has inspired many other performers across the years. One moment his vocal style can pull at your heartstrings, the next moment jolt you into stark portrayals of the truth demanding every ounce of your attention. The fourth dimension is his ability to produce work that is timeless, relevant and pertinent to today, underlining his status as Britain's most credible socio-politically aware singer-songwriter, acoustic orchestra, electric folk warrior, rock poet thunderstorm, bohemian commando or one in a field of one. However you perceive him, Roy Harper is a unique and extraordinary individual. What follows is my attempt to throw some light on one of our most legendary musicians.
It's very rare to find an artist with your longevity, one who continually attracts a young audience, but it seems to me that your standards have a lot to do with that. How do you maintain your sort of quality control?
Oh, Jesus. I guess it's like... it's a different question. It's like, how do you maintain yourself? I think it's more like that. I think that it's very... It's crucial. The most crucial thing that I can... that I experience is how I'm thinking. And I don't expect that ever to be deflected very much. From what was going on when I was round about six. I had a very clear idea when I was round about six about what was happening around me, and I don't think that very many of my ideas have changed since I was about nine. So, it's kind of maintenance, really.
Yeah.
That's what it is, it's just maintenance. And not letting it slip, don't get too far into something that you've let yourself go. Don't give up.
Yeah, definitely that.
don't give up. That's what it is. It's more like that.
You've got a very strong rapport with the audiences, and I think like the Intersum chats contribute to like, a very friendly and special atmosphere, and it creates a sort of overall experience that's quite unique to each gig. And
yes.
I was wondering how that sort of interactive thing came about, whether it's sort of like partly the heritage of the, you know, the folk club era, or if it's just something that's totally intrinsic to yourself.
Oh, it's both. And also, it differs on night to night to night to night. Because some nights you can't hear them at all, because, and they'd say in plenty, but you can't hear them because the monitors are so loud and everything around you is so kind of isolated on a stage that a little voice in the middle of nowhere you're not able to hear, so you're not able to respond. But in a place where you are able to hear, your response is much better. Yeah. And their response is likewise then, and then it makes for, you know, then it makes for a good gig.
Yeah.
So I think it's got something to do with, it has something to do with farce, really. It has a lot to do with farce. I mean, Billy Connolly gave up singing folk music because he'd rather stand on stage and be what he really is, funny.
Yeah.
You know, and I guess that if I hadn't have been so inclined in the way that I am, it's down to inspirations in that respect. If I hadn't have been inspired by people like Percy Shelley when I was about 10 years old, then I might have lived a very different life altogether. I might have gone into scripted comedy or, you know, something completely different like that. And been able to have such a script together that at any given moment you could go off on a tangent and you know, and come back again. And there are many people who can do that, and you know, Billy does it very, very well.
Yeah.
But I think it's a kind of a tradition here in Britain as well. We have been over the centuries pretty inward looking, and that's, I suppose that's part and parcel of being in Ireland. But it's also particularly, I think it's a tribal thing as well. And I think we derive a lot of our humour from looking in the mirror and looking at others and just, you know, there's a lot of poking fun goes on here. It's very infectious. And it's infected the whole nation, and it's been a long time infection now. It's moved ahead, I think, a lot ahead of many of the rest of the European traditions. I mean, they're ahead of us in other ways. But, you know, and you shouldn't think about ahead anyway, but I think it's from that sort of a region that I'm coming. But if I, the problem is, I'm inspired by the poets. So I'm always going to give in that direction, rather than in any other. It's kind of it's the making of me, and also the downfall of me.
Indian
poetry. Yeah, it's this. Yeah, next.
When did you first pick up the guitar?
When I was about 12 or 13.
On Come Out Fighting Genghis Smith, you sang, I don't need wealth and I don't want fame. How do you feel about the whole sort of concept of fame these days?
Oh, it's rather weird now. Mind you, it always was. it's sort of... I've always had a take-it-or-leave-it attitude to it. I'm much more interested in what I'm doing rather than anything like that. It's It's very funny. I'd kind of have people come up to me in the street and say, can I have your autograph? And, you know, you can go for months without that happening, and all of a sudden it'll happen three times. And you think, I'm not famous. I'm me.
Yeah.
What's, you know, and you, I integrate with other people and communicate with other people on the same level as they communicate with me. There's no sort of, there has never been a barrier between me and anybody that I know. If it's the bank manager, I'll treat him like the bank manager, and he treats me like the customer, you know. And if it's the car mechanic, he treats me like a different kind of customer, and we're nearer to being friends, you know.
Yeah.
And much nearer, actually. So it depends on the person.
Yeah, sure.
It depends on you know.
You've played a lot of festivals over the years, and it was on a video featuring performances from Stonehenge 84 that I actually first found out about you. And compared to the 60s, certainly late 60s, what do you think about the contemporary festivals?
Well, it's a business machine now. It's and it has all the manifestations of that, so that you go and you arrive and you expect this and that and that and that and that and that and that and that, whatever. That's the reason that people go, and the more attractions there are, the more likely you are to spread your accessibility to people, so that, you know, the cash register's ticking over. It didn't used to be like that at all. It used to be that you went for the pleasure of to be quite brutally frank, getting out of it and getting into the sounds. You know, you can still do that, very much so, but it's like there's this haunting ching behind everything.
Yeah, you're right. A lot of the less commercial events, and an awful lot of people's lives are going to be really affected if the criminal justice bill comes in. How do you feel about that thing?
Well, I think it's a load of rubbish, but I mean, I think you know what I think about that.
I think
you ought to print what you think.
Yeah.
And it'll be about what I think.
Yeah, that's fair. What was it about The Prison, the TV series, that inspired McGoon's Blues, or certainly the title? And was it having spent some time yourself at, you know, Her Majesty's Pleasure, or was it like being a prisoner in a misguided society? Sort of
both. All of those. And it's the big problem that you've got with writing things like that is that you don't want them to be true, but increasingly they are. So that over the years you think, hey, I wrote something that's... Oh, fuck, did I? Shit, did I? Oh, dear. Well, maybe the next time I can write something that fantasizes instead. And then I won't have to look back and say, you were right, Roy! Ha ha! Ha ha! You were right! Ha! Oh, fuck. You were right. Oh, shit. You know. It's terrible just to think about a little man like me, a little boy as I was, writing a song like that, and it's still being a valid thing to say now. And I can't actually see the time when it won't be. It's sort of that it is going. It's fairly timeless. I didn't think it was going to be. I didn't think about things like that. I've ended up writing some kind of timeless music.
Yeah.
That's what I'm into. Yeah. But I didn't think about that then. It was a sort of it was almost stream of consciousness. And so I kind of you sort of have withdrawal symptoms from it. You know, you don't want it to be there, and at the same time, it's the same as what I was saying tonight. It's like a hollow victory. It's a very hollow victory. But yuck.
This question from Paul Davison, who does the electronic mailing list, Stockholm mailing list, and in Begoon's Blues, you mentioned computer-stained fingers. What's your opinion of people with sort of similarly discoloured digits these days? I mean, bearing in mind as well that the internet is possibly the last sort of really, you know, free information highway, something that isn't controlled or observed intently.
Yeah. I think there's an incredible wealth of communication that's been got into via computer. And I think in those terms, it's a wonderful contraption, a wonderful invention. And I've got two myself, right? So my fingers are as stained as everyone else's. But in the other sense, where they've got you all on file somewhere,
yeah.
It's like the closing of a million doors behind you. Mm. You can hear the big slam.
Yeah. We've seen you bring out the harmonica recently, so the garage and ground. Freeze to the Sun. Have you ever tried dabbling with any other instruments over the years? I know at one point you wanted to have a go with piano.
Yeah, it's just it's a dabble though. The problem is that someone like Phil Collins, for instance, who starts life out as a drummer, has to then diverge, has to. Maintain a different, has to develop a different musicality in order to survive the changes that are happening around him. I think that at some time he's probably tried the guitar and found out how really difficult it is. You never actually see him playing one of those. But you do see him at the keyboard where all of the notes are regulated. You know, it's a mathematical job.
Yeah.
The guitar's much less like that altogether. And so I think to maintain a pop career, I think it's necessary to diverge into other instruments. I think that Neil Young is the best diverger. I think he's by far and away the most dedicated of all of us to everything he does. He's more dedicated to music than I am, you know, and he's just as dedicated with what he's saying. So he's actually a bit more dedicated than I am, you know, and I respect him highly. So yes, I regret that I've never actually managed to be inspired enough to get into anything else, and I should have been. I really should have been, because the piano is a really, it can be a wonderful instrument, but I'm afraid that my inspiration is just purely on the words.
Yeah.
And it's going to stay there, you know. I could spend 3 or 4 years learning how to play the piano quite well.
No, I'll stick with the words.
Yeah, we'll stick with the words. That was a decision I made, Dave.
Yeah. On the album Stormcock, in between One Man Rock and Roll Band and Me and My Woman, there's what I think is a snippet from Shay of Valentine, which was released 3 years ago.
Yeah.
So I've often wondered, why is it like some sort of future echo?
Yeah. That's what it was intended to be. Yeah. I don't think you need... Next.
Well, South Africa is a beautiful song, and it's quite rightly lasted the course as a live favourite. But following the elections over there, you know, do you think you could dare to predict how things might go for them?
Well, I think the lunatic right has appeared recently in the last month to have kind of accepted their lot, as they did in Rhodesia and Zimbabwe, because there was a lunatic right there, and it would be better for them to accept their lot. The numbers involved in South Africa are very much bigger, and so therefore you can at some stage envision like a highly trained white army of considerable number putting themselves between all the people and democracy there. But I don't think it'll actually happen, because there's too much awareness now and focus on and by the international community. And I think the international community now has sufficient weight to actually to stop something like that in its tracks. But I have a feeling that these days that events can be affected, really affected, by one thing that happens. And I think that the one thing that happened that was good, it was obviously bad as well, but the one thing that happened that the world saw on TV, that actually everybody went, oh dear, and the South African right wing must have gone, oh dear, and they must have chewed their lips and said bastard a 5,000 times and not been able to do anything about it, and then not knowing what to do. And then it was the shooting of those guys who were pleading for mercy that they didn't deserve at all at the time. And everybody saw the dilemma. And everybody saw the absolute truth about what was going on, that they actually deserved to be shot through the head right there and then. That murder's wrong. But that's what was actually, that was in a microcosm what was going to happen. And when you stand back from things like that and you think, I think it has a big effect on everyone. It's worldwide. And I think that the guy being shot by the US colonel in the head in Vietnam was a big, like, it was like a big blow for the Americans, that. It was like sort of, what the fuck are we doing here? You know, with guys who just take the law into their own hands like that, just take a gun out and shoot someone through the fucking head. What? You know, it's like, okay, let's stand back from this a minute and see. I think it's a good move to have de Klerk as vice president. I think that's a very good move. I think Nelson Mandela's one of the most magnanimous souls on earth.
He's a nice survivor.
Certainly, a great man. So one of the greatest men of our times. Anyway, next.
There's some footage in the film Made, which shows you a large outdoor festival. I don't know what the festival was.
Hyde Park Free Concert.
Right, and I think it was, you were playing Highway Blues.
Yeah.
Yeah. Do you know if anyone still has a copy of that festival performance? Anyway.
I don't know. It's possible that EMI do.
Because it was filmed and then found and then used.
Yes, it was whoever made that film. They possibly have. I don't think they really filmed me so much as the event.
Yeah.
I don't think there was much, you know, footage of that. What we should have done at the time was to say, can we have the footage that you're not using? Mm. Because you don't think. That's one of my big problems. I've never actually. If I'd have magpied everything like that, then, you know, you could say, hey, look at this scene from, you know, and do a big number with it. But I've never actually bothered much. In recent times, this is untrue, but I've never bothered much about the past. I'm always in the middle of the next step. And so I don't know where the past is scattered. It's really scattered. So I don't know. I've no idea. It's possible.
Yeah, I was also going to ask the same thing about the Albert Hall film. There's a 16 mil around somewhere. I just wonder if that will ever find its way onto
it. It is awful.
Is it? Oh dear.
It is awful. It's great. It's fantastic. It was obviously in the infancy of video altogether. I mean, it was done professionally. And the tape's about that wide. And it's like that. And it was green not so long ago. And so we opened the box, there was mould on it.
Yeah. It sounds a bit desperate, doesn't it?
And they took it away and had it transferred to tape with slightly better imaging, but there was nothing they could do about the actual cameraman on the day. There was nothing that they were able to do about him. So the angle that the camera was finally left at, I don't know whether it died or whether it actually fell gradually, right? I don't know, it was about there. So it's kind of 45 degrees. So you've got Paige walking on stage like that, coming towards you at 45 degrees. You know. And Nick, age 6 or 7 or 8 or something, coming up to the microphone, you wonder what the hell he's going to do. You know, and I've watched it with a sort of almost morbid interest, you know. I thought, what the hell is he trying to do? What is he trying to do? And he's grappling around. And he suddenly gets what he wanted. It's the microphone. And he pulls it towards him. And he says, bye-bye! Right, and goes at this angle. Fucking hell. Yeah, you know. So it's awful. It's really awful.
From that camp, where are you? Put instructions in the video, sort of sticks and books under your telly or something, and swing the screen up.
Yeah, we stuck some books under the telly for you, folks. It still doesn't look right because there's these corners missing. But imagine that the camera was that way. Anyway, we've given you the option.
In the accompanying booklet to Valentine, you said that war between sexes may be a valid way of life for some, but it has to be profoundly stupid. Reflecting stuff like Mel Shows, Pig Blues and Magic Woman, how do you relate to feminism 20 years on?
Well, it's in the place it should always be. It's gone. It's gone. Your time is up. It's in the place it always was. I think that's another thing that's benefited hugely from media exposure, because it's obvious to people. George Bernard Shaw said about 1950 that you politicians, you can't lie anymore, you've got the camera to face, you know, and or words to that effect. And it's absolutely true that once you get a caterwauling menagerie of females who have been deprived in a big what should I call it? Cacophony on TV, then you can sit back and say, okay, go on then, ladies, kill yourselves. But if you start talking sense, I'm going to be listening. You know?
Yeah.
So people are taken for what they actually are and what they're actually saying that makes sense to everybody. And I think that people like Germaine Greer, who for a long time was labelled as like feminist idiot, is now risen. Just one or two of them, she's risen so far above that and beyond that, that you know, feminism is for wise people and for idiots who can't really get on with the opposite sex that well. I mean, you have to what we all have to do is to make sure that we are all equal within the bounds of possibility. Some are always going to be more equal than others. I mean, I saw a woman today who had knees up to my eyebrow, legs up to my eyebrows. I'm not joking. And I had to actually look round at her. I had to. It was a freak show. It was a freak show walking down the King's Road. And she wanted to be a freak show. That's what she wanted to be, exactly. She was 6 foot... about 6 foot three, and made like every Vogue front cover that you've seen in the last 10 years. You know, and you had to have a look. You knew that it was like hands off. You know absolutely that no one is going to get anywhere near that for the next 30 or 40 years till it sort of comes out of that shell. You know, it's something by itself. It's something that you just look at. You go, hey, fuck, look at that freak. Shit. Wow, and she wanted to do it. And she got the reaction out of me and everybody else that she wanted to get. And, you know, it's just basic, pure male, wow. But when I actually went well and thought about it, I thought, nothing to do with you, Roy, at all. Nothing to do with you whatsoever. Forget it. You know. And went back to being Roy immediately. You know. So people play with you. They play around, but, you know, you've got the brain. You can see through it.
Yeah. Can you tell me about that famous night, the rainbow on Valentine's Day in 74.
Oh, Christ. Where should I start?
Just a...
Breakfast.
A couple of impressions, brief impressions. Just.
Getting Mooney out of bed to start with was like hell on earth. You know, I mean, he didn't even know that he got any more gigs left ever. You know, it was sort of horrendous. The effort involved in getting him out of bed and getting him to the rainbow was exhausting. It was really, really exhausting. And then, when he got me exhausted and off my fucking feet, I said to him, Jesus, when he started to go and into an upward direction. Those were his words. He said, I said, Jesus, I'm feeling tired. How am I going to do this tonight? And he turned around and he said, here, I got something for you. I thought, oh, yeah, that's exactly what I thought. Oh, no. And he got a briefcase and he opened it and there was rows of drugs. There was just rows of drugs and the whole thing in the bottom was like full of... And he must have recognised all of it. And he sort of took something out and he said, here, take those two right now and that'll put you in an upward direction. Right? And he fiddles around a bit more, pulls out another canister, tips out another pill, really big red one, and says, and take that about 11 o'clock and that'll keep you going straight. Keep going straight. Says, and then when you've had enough of that, take those two. That'll carry you, you know. And I thought, fucking hell, here I am, I've got my night planned for me.
Chemically engineered evening.
Yeah, you know, yes, the chemically engineered evening. Well, there are many impressions, but that one's unforgettable. Absolutely unforgettable.
On reflection, why do you think it was that Trigger didn't work in the long term? Was it, the obvious thing that cropped up soon after that? Or do you think it's just the public just can't cope with that kind of intelligent rock?
Combination, yeah. The combination of intelligent lyrics and rock out. I think that is very difficult for them to... That's very, very, very... They've got to be cultured into that. I think Neil Young has managed to do it to some degree. And he's done it over the years, and it's taken him a long time. But I think that a population, of a segment of the population has to be into you to start with, on a pop level perhaps, and then be carried for a lifetime by your own progression. I think it's sort of something like that. But there's a larger question there, isn't there? What's your original question?
It was just why do you thought it was the trigger didn't work out in the long?
Yeah.
I mean, another thing I was wondering if it might be because it would be difficult to portray a really true cross section of all your work in a purely band format. I mean, you'd have to have.
Well, it is, of course. It is. And that's one of the bugbears. That's one of the drawbacks of being me, is I can't do that stuff all at the same time. You've got to give people, a relatively accessible evening, but I think that the crucial thing with that band, and it's such a shame, I think Bill Bruford was perhaps the odd one out, but he was the most technically gifted of all of us. And he could, the big problem is that he could have a job anywhere, anytime he wanted, and will do for the rest of his life. I mean, he's an excellent drummer. But Spedding didn't like how busy he was. He just used to say in his Sheffield, brogue, he's too busy. And Bruford didn't like Spedding either, because he thought that Spedding was too minimalist. So it was like these two figures who didn't really like each other, but that the band was good. It was really good. And Dave would have gone anyway. Dave would have gone whichever way it had gone, and improved as a player, and etc. And it's such a shame that that band didn't stay together, because I know that Spedding thinks of it as some of his best work on record, and I know that he wanted to get it back together again, sort of 10 years later, and I was into something else, and he was, and we could easily have done it, and we still could probably, but it's not going to be the same again. We should have actually have kept it together. We should have kept it together. And we didn't. Because, if we'd have kept it together, that band would have gone. It would have gone places. It would have been. That's the one point in my life that I regret not holding on to people. Because I think that band was really, really good. Maybe we did need a different drummer, but I think Bill was... I think Bill's a great, great drummer, and I think that eventually the two of them would have settled into each other, and I think it's a shame, that's all. I just think it's a shame. Maybe it's me that they couldn't have taken eventually. What the f*** are you writing about now, you clown? Why do we have to sing your words all the time? Why is, who needs a damn front man, especially when he can't sing like Peter Gabriel?
Yeah. Which of your own albums are you fondest?
Sorry, can I just ask you, would you ever work with any band again, do you think? You've worked with a band for a long time.
I think so. I mean, that's going to happen next week anyway at Cropperty, but
yeah,
it's going to happen on the 10th with Ian Anderson. I don't know what the hell is going to happen there. But it's always I'm so damn idiosyncratic now that it's very, very difficult for anybody really to work with me. I mean, I went down to... Well, no, perhaps that's the wrong story. I come across all the time bands full of people who are terrific players. They're terrific players. They can outstrip me, whack, like that. You know, Nick's on that sort of level. You could join any band and fit in anywhere, anytime. But since I've become, I've gone further and further and further out on a limb, on my own particular limb, it's become increasingly hard for me to actually get it together with other people again because I need to take the extra breath and have the extra bar in there. And I need to actually, that's what I was saying to Nick when I first came up, I should not play the guitar anymore. I shouldn't be playing the guitar anymore, I should be singing. That's what I should be doing. The band should actually poke me into action. They should go, now, do it now. We're beginning to play. We're going to play now, Roy. Roy! Yeah, you know, stop talking. Come around. Yes, there's a good boy, right? He's got hold of the mic and don't. And I think that it would be very much better because that I would be organized. But once whilst I'm still the orchestra, the entire orchestra, then I've got too much power. I've got far too much power. I can stop when I want to stop. I can stop the whole band. Hey, guess what? I've had a thought. Yeah, yeah. Oh, yeah, I just thought, I must go and see my dentist. You know, so, you know, it's crazy. You've just got too much power. And if I had a band, I would be more disciplined. I see these guys all the time, and they're brilliant. And I come away from a session with them thinking, Jesus, what does it take to be like that? To actually just fit in like that, to go, oh, what you mean this? And just do it.
Yeah.
And you know, and it's wonderful. I just stand back and go, wow. You know, it was such a pleasure to be with you guys because you're actually so damn professional. And then I wonder what they think about me. You know, Roy, what does he do? Well, he sits on a stage and sometimes it gets a bit iffy. You know, sometimes the audience have to squirm a little, just a little. And then sometimes they're in hysterics because, you know, he's done something really foolish. And you can't have a band doing that. It's sort of really weird. There will be another time, yes, but I'll have to get into another discipline. It is another discipline. Next.
Just quickly, which of your own albums are you fondest of?
Well, I often think about things like that. And it's kind of constantly shifting tide. There are one or two that are at the top all the time, but they're like sort of rocks poking out of the sea. I don't want to get too far into that analogy, but if you like, there's a joint first. And it's a joint first, and it contains Stormcock, HQ, Bull in a Ming Vase, I think that I'm forced to put Life Mask in with those two. It sort of forces me to put, and therefore Valentine is kind of forced to be in there. And then Flat Baroque is forced because of that to be in there. Right? And then it gets a bit weird. And then I think, hold on, Roy, you can't have six or seven or whatever it is in first place. Okay, we'll have those six in that place. And we'll have a sixth place. So what do we have in sixth place? Okay, in sixth place we've got Folk Joke Opus. Definitely Descendants of Smith. That should really have been in one of the first places, very often is, and once, and the last one isn't too bad when all is said and done. And then Sophisticated Beggar, and what are we going to do with that? That's joint sixth as well, you know. And so you go on down the list like that, and then the most relevant question is, I suppose, which is out of the list? And you have to think, right, I know that one. I know which are not in the list. And the sort of joint 15th or something will be come out fighting, but it shouldn't be. It should be slightly ahead of that. But then you've got... We'll have come out fighting joint 15th on its own, you know, or something. Then 16th, you've got Burn the World, which isn't... It isn't. It's just not very good. The ideas, the whole thing, is okay, but it's never reached the proper place where it should have reached. It is a double or triple record. I never exploited it. It never actually reached the target. It's an arrow in midair. Somebody will get it together someday. That's where you're at. And that's also where Work of Heart is. That's the other one. That's the real... I don't really want to play that record. That record's not really... There's some good songs, like Drawn to the Flames. It's really great. And I Am a Child is good too. There's another good one on there.
Elizabeth.
So, yeah, but there's the beginnings of Elizabeth. Elizabeth's better on Jugular. There is another one, I've forgotten what it is. But anyway, I don't want to... Because that's another one that never reached the target. You know, that's when you were governed by 25 minutes on the side of a record, and you had to do something in 25 minutes. You couldn't fade it and carry it, or could you? And did you want to? Could you do it in one go? Blah, 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 blah. Blah, blah, blah. And some of the poetry, and it's really good, and it was still born, because that band actually didn't work as well as the HQ band. It never worked as well, and I now know why. I couldn't put my finger on it at the time, but I know why now, and I don't want to say.
Fair enough.
So, you know, you've got the stragglers. The stragglers are those three. Born in Captivity is Born in Captivity is better than those. But yeah. Those Work of Heart and Burn the World never reached. They're like I say, they're arrows in midair. Yeah. The rest, as you could, somebody said to me the other day, well, you've never made a bad record. Yes, there are, but they're sort of hidden. They're hidden by the decent stuff. Yeah. And there's still some decent poetry on them anyway. But, you know, I don't want to get...
It's true. When you're on stage with Nick, and something towards the end of Same Old Rock, and Nick's got a free rein, and flying away. I've seen you kind of glance across with a bit, some nice to be a mixture of joy and pride. Can you put that into words?
Jesus Christ. Well, no, he's a fully fledged adult human being. He's his own man, very much so. I think he appreciates what his dad has done and who his dad is. And he probably appreciates that more than his dad does. Because, you know, his dad's the twit that walks down the street and, you know, looks for somewhere to piss. You know, where no one can see him, like, and ends up pissing in the bushes. You know, because he can't be bothered to go into the cafe and buy and ask to use the loo at that point. He has to look right now about, okay, where can I piss, and just do it now. You know, and it's, I mean, I react like that. I am like that. And I guess he's right when he's got me down to a T. He knows exactly what's going on, you know. He knows when I've sort of flown the coop for 10 minutes and I'm not, you know, I'm sort of on planet Zarg. You know, and he can take that. It's, you know, it's part and parcel of living with me, I think. But it's not a serious condition, and I guess that Crazy Boys, which is the song he's written for me, is like a, it's very, very flattering. It's very, very flattering to have somebody, an adult human being, actually have those, be able to be explicit with those emotions for you. But I regard him as an equal, like as another human being, because never will I ever be able to afford to be any different with him or anybody else, because the moment you start thinking that, the ground disappears from underneath you and you start becoming, you know, the arsehole that you see blah 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 wherever. So you've got to retain humility, and I love him deeply, and it's mutual, but it'll last for the rest of my life. But we're both saddled with each other. We're saddled with each other, and it's forever. Sometimes it's kind of mildly annoying, but most of the time it's filled with a deep sense of pride. You know.
Yeah, the only thing I was going to just ask was just plans for the future with that. You're over an island from that. If you have much time to do the studio, what might be coming together for next year on the album?
Well, yes, there's a song I've got. There's a song cycle I've got up and running called Seven Ages of Man. But the more I think about it, the bigger it gets.
It's huge.
So, you know, the starting point is conception, or even before, right? And the end is obviously decay. There, you know, there's tragedy in every life at the end, and that's part of it. And there are lots of things along the way, and I'm trying to get some of my favourite themes in along the way at the sort of times they happened to me, at the sort of times they occurred to me. So there are the songs like, for instance, you know, I'll try my best to pick a banjo up for this one, but it'll be, I don't want to be a part-time daddy, not there when you need somebody. Right, I won't sing the rest of that. But that's around about the age of 30, I would think. And there are other things like there's a battle going on at the moment about whether it would be more successful to have a republic And so there's a song called Republic, bound to be on there. Absolutely bound to be on there. And then there's another song, which I'm not going to give you the title of, because I'll blow it.
Yeah.
There's lots of things that are going on in my head. It's just it's just arranging them properly.
Sure.
And having the time to. Well, it's been lovely to see you.
Yeah,
I hope that the charabang doesn't break down on the way back.
Yeah, that's great. Yeah. Thanks for your time. That's great.
Thanks a lot, Dave, for letting me run that interview on the podcast. Really enjoyed listening to that again, and it was quite fun hearing me name-checked during the interview. Of course, back in 1994, I was running the Stormcott mailing list, an email discussion group, really. There was no podcast, there was no fancy website, but even then we were going strong and having a lot of fun discussing the gigs and what was going to happen next with the records and everything. Happy days. A bit of music now, and I'm going to play MCP Blues, since it was mentioned during the interview, and this is a version from the BBC tapes, Volume 2.
This is a song that was a predecessor of that one. In a weird sort of a sense.
Now it's time for the A to Z of Harper. It's the letter Y this month, and I've chosen the track You Don't Need Money from Roy's second album, Come Out Fighting Genghis Smith. I've always liked this very tongue-in-cheek track, and I really liked it when Roy started playing it live a few years ago. I kind of thought that he'd grown to hate that album and everything on it, so I was really pleased when he started playing it. In his book, Roy says, "This song found itself on the first compilation in rock history, The Rock Machine Turns You On, and got me a lot of mileage and a peculiar reputation for a while." We'd done the whole student number in Yugoslavia 2 or 3 years beforehand. We came down the coast from Trieste. Sarajevo to Nice was the biggest adventure. We got out of there with a lift from a Turkish army officer. Undulating terrain and eons of chat.
Nobody's got any money in the summer. Oh dear me, what a terrible drag. I couldn't get very much phenomenon in summer. Beseeching the red man be as soft as he can. Cause I've got a little money coming when I sell my MBA. All the folky student population wearing rucksacks, taking my meal ticket over the seas. And half the blasted idiots are stuck in Yugoslavia with hardly a dinar. And looking no cleaner than a Chinese wrestler's jockstrap cooked in chip fat on a greasy day. And think what money could do for my tummy. And think what my tummy could do for my mind. And think what my mind could do for the world, for the stars and infinity. Anybody got any money for the strummer? I won't need much in the parasol shade, but I could have used a million quid a year ago last summer to grace the Bahamas in see-through pajamas. But never mind, I'm worth 2 buns of sherbet and a licorice root. A root too. Nobody's got any money in the summer. Oh dear me, and if I was stoned out of my mind at park, I'd say that nobody needs any money in the summer. Except, of course, for scoring on a Sunday.
Time for a bit of listener feedback. First of all, I had an email from Alan. He says, "Hi Paul, congratulations on and thanks for retaining your principles and turning down the sponsorship deal, which I mentioned last month. This week I've noticed that our council have been flogging off advertising space on the traffic roundabouts, which are now sponsored by a local company. Good to see that some people are still willing to say no to those who think everything has a price. Advertising in the sky, they'd like to stick it in your eyes," saying Steve Winwood back in 1978. Crude, but even more true now. Thanks a lot, Alan. Nice to have that encouragement. And I had a fairly long comment on the website from Arthur Precarious, which I'm going to read in full. "Hi, Paul. I think I've listened to all the podcasts. It's great to hear discussion and chat about Roy somewhere. I remember Roy saying many years ago that he thought he'd only be fully appreciated after he was dead. Sad, but possibly true. I've been a Harper fan since HQ and have seen him around a dozen times now, always eventful. Once walked back from Bradford to then home of Skipton, about 20 miles after watching a very stoned Roy with Andy Roberts when he only got through about 6 songs. Another time in Sheffield with the Roy Harper band when he mooned the audience. I think that was the night he had told the story about pissing over a well-heeled crowd in LA who wouldn't listen to him. Anyway, with regards to the podcasts, I don't want to sound churlish, but would it be possible to talk to more people who have strong links with Roy for future podcasts? Chris Spedding, Dave Gilmore, John Leckie, people who have worked with him closely. Perhaps a listener profile too? I always kind of wondered why Roy wasn't more successful. Fancied writing something on that theme, when will Roy be famous kind of thing. Some say it's because he won't play the game, and while there's a truth in that, Dylan, Lou Reed and Neil Young don't play the game, and they do all right. It would be nice if you could do another interview with Roy and get listeners to email questions in. Well, thanks again. Keep it up. Thank you, Arthur. I have a bit of a problem at the moment with interviews. I'm kind of running out. I'm running out of people to talk to. And the famous people, the well-known people, I'm having not very much success, frankly, with getting them on board. And in the light of that and the fact that Roy's kind of in semi-retirement, I'm going to stop doing it monthly. Next month will be out as usual when I finish the A to Z of Harper with Zed. But I'm going to fall back to producing podcasts when and if there's something useful to say or I've got a good interview in hand. It's becoming very difficult to do these monthly and keep on topic. And yours is not the only feedback I've had about the interviews particularly going wildly off topic and with people that that nobody's ever heard of. And I'm sorry about that, but this is a pretty tough gig, really. And I think it would be better for quality if I, as I say, do it when I've got something useful to say. Best way of keeping track, of course, is to subscribe to the podcast via iTunes or some other podcast aggregator, and then you'll get them as and when I publish them. I've still got plans and I've still got people that have provisionally agreed to be interviewed, but I haven't managed to get into the studio or on the phone yet, so I'm still working on it, but it's a bit tricky. Okay. Finally, and a comment from Alan Jones. He says, "Hi, I was at that Bradford gig too and walked 10 miles home to Huddersfield, where I was living then, energised by the whole thing. It was the best Harper gig I ever went to, possibly because it was the only one and only time I saw him perform same old rock. Sadly, it was the last time I ever saw him play as well. Just never been in the right part of the country to catch him live since then. As for why he never got more famous and just stays a cult hero, I agree, it's not just because he doesn't play the game. I think it's a combination of not playing the game, including his tendency to self-sabotage, and his wrangles with his major record label. The other people you mentioned, and I think you can add Van Morrison to the list of people who don't play the game, were all a bit different from Roy. Dylan was on a major label from the start, and I think he did play the game until he was a big enough star to be able to do whatever the hell he liked. He also got in there first, and as a solo artist managed to be the template for the singer-songwriter ever after. Since Dylan is only about a month older than Roy, I wonder what would have happened if Roy hadn't been such a late starter. Would we have had Roy as Britain's answer to Dylan instead of Donovan? Would Roy have been on Ready, Steady, Go and Top of the Pops? Somehow, I think not. The other difference between Roy and Lou Reed, Neil Young and Van Morrison, is that before starting out solo, these three all had careers in bands which either had hit records or were very influential, so they had a reputation which generated interest which they didn't have to create on the back of their own talents alone. And Lou Reed and Neil Young may both have made Fuck You albums like Weld and Metal Machine Music, i.e. not playing the game. I'm not suggesting Roy's ever made a Fuck You album, but he's certainly done some Fuck You gigs. Well done on the swearing there, Alan. You've got more fucks in that sentence than... Anyway, but they didn't do so until they had already made albums that had sold shitloads. Very thought-provoking and well-written, thank you. Just to finish off the podcast, some credits and copyright. This podcast is issued under a Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivatives Works 2.0 UK, England and Wales licence, which means you can share it with others. You can't change it, claim you made it or charge any money for it. The Roy Harper Music in this podcast is used by kind permission of Science Fiction Limited and isn't for copying or redistribution. Email me any comments or post on the website. If you want to send me an MP3 or voicemail, that's great. If you want to call a phone number and leave a message, 90 second limit, in the UK 01223 850282. Outside the UK plus 44 1223 850282. And that's it for this month. Cheerio.